Set down your sleepy water and your Mr. Whistle. Take off that raincoat and grab a cold beer. It's time to have a real talk about pediatric dentistry. You're listening to Bruise and Tiny Teeth, the unfiltered pediatric dentistry podcast.
So anyways, Josh, thank you for hopping on the podcast. And I know we've been kind of working this out for a little while, but I was anxious to get you on. And before we dive in and start talking some clinical stuff, you know, I think you might be the first guest, I could be wrong, but maybe the first guest who's a private practice owner from the state of California. I've had some associates on, but I know you and I were talking off air yesterday about, you know, California. I have not spent a lot of time out there, but my impression is California is it's beautiful, but can be more of an expensive and tax heavy place because you're a numbers guy like I am. You know, enlighten me. What's the scene out there in California from like a private practice standpoint?
So I love the weather. I'll take that any day of the week. But, you know, one of the challenges that we have, you know, I listened to your podcast yesterday on the way out running some errands. I thought it was excellent on overhead percentages, right?
Thank you.
And this is something that everybody struggles with, especially I think it affects you whether you're new to pediatric dentistry or if you've been in practice for a while. And sometimes maybe if you've been in practice for a while and you have a mature practice, is our the biggest overhead component for any of us is staff, right? And we know that there's just this national shortage of staff members, right? And people are coming in. I'm getting applications. People are wanting $35, $40 an hour with almost no experience. And that's getting into hygienist dollars, right? And so it gets to be tough if, as pediatric dentists, we're a staff-heavy operation, right? It's not like endo where an endodontist has maybe one person up front and a couple people at back. Is we need that auxiliary staff. And not only do we need staff, we need good staff, staff that's well-trained, that can be independent, that you don't have to check every single one of their patients that they have open contacts on their bite wings. So it can be a drain to us as practice owners of making sure, number one, that you even have people. And number two, as your practice gets busier, are you spending the time training that staff so you're not just on this hamster wheel, that you really have good people? And if you can have a large staff, but if they're not well trained, it can be a big hindrance to practice growth for anybody. But California, I think especially, that's one of the things that we struggle with.
Mm-hmm. The staffing. And to your point, I've had some off-air conversations with some other pediatric dentists, like philosophically on, I think the offices that are getting hit hard right now are the ones that are the really busy turn and burn, like 80, 90, 100 kids a day practices, because those offices tend to go through staff members so much faster and burn them out. And you're not really in the days where it was just easy to go pick somebody up off the street. Like the staff members are valuable. And so if you burn them out, then you're really in trouble. And then you got 100 kids a day and you're down two team members. So like it's kind of changed. I think that's a harder way to practice, is that sheer volume game compared to what it used to be, because the staffing is so much more challenging than what it used to be.
You are absolutely correct. And it's not only burning your staff out, but just making sure, well, no, I think it is burning your staff out. I mean, we invest so much in our staff. And if you don't pause and take some time to take care of your staff and make sure that, you know, they get a break or that you actually have training, you're just on this giant hamster wheel. And I have a busy, mature practice, but I never want to be so busy where I'm not spending time with my patients and my staff is leaving at the end of the day and they're burned out, because nobody's happy after that. And it's not a way to practice for a long time.
Yeah. Tell me more about, I kind of briefly looked up the area of California you're practicing in, but again, I'm not familiar with the West Coast, but your area, I mean, tell me about how long have you been out there? When did you start that practice? And it's kind of the general outside of San Francisco area, but kind of tell me about that area of California that you're out there.
You got it. So I had things, I was pretty lucky to be a second generation pediatric dentist. So my dad graduated UCLA and then USC Pedo back in the 70s. And so I just hit my 20-year mark being in private practice. So I went to University of Texas, Houston. It was the only time I left California, really. And it was phenomenal, you know, classic program, heavy anesthesia sedation. I came out with a IV permit, which was wonderful. Cool. You know, really good classic operative dentistry, which, you know, we'll probably get into is very different. A lot of things are different than I do now. So, you know, at that, when I came out of school, I worked for my dad. I worked for some other practices. He didn't want me just to work for him because he wanted me to see what it was like, you know, in other areas. And I worked for some, you know, really busy practices and slower practices. And I thankfully was able to work for a friend, and I learned how to run a larger practice, but still quality, where you're spending your time with your patients, you're spending your time with your parents. So now at 20 years, I've really hit a good stride where I feel, you know, comfortable in my clinical skills, comfortable in my skills as a practice owner. You know, I'm really striving to learn every single day. And now coming up here in a couple months, I'm currently building a new facility, really the practice location of my dreams and a teaching facility there. So I've really hit that kind of stride. You know, I look at my age and I don't plan on retiring anymore, but after 20 years, I really want to, you know, I'm at a place where I'm happy with my clinical skills and my office manager skills, but there's always room to learn. And that's why I love doing things like this. You know, yesterday I listened to a bunch of your podcasts in a row, and all of us, I think, are eternal students. So I'm just happy to be here.
That's awesome. I appreciate that. So, you know, you've been doing this for 20 years. I'm always interested to talk to guys that have been in this game longer than I have, but is it safe to say your patient population has changed from, you know, when you started with a lot more young kids, knee to knee exams, infant tots, like, cause we're going to talk about it, but I know you're very involved in like a lot of aesthetic dentistry, class threes, composite techniques. Like, does that lend itself well to your practice because maybe your patient base is, do you have a lot more teenage kids and older kids to use those techniques on then?
That is exactly it. That's exactly it. You know, when I was young and building the practice, I mean, we still see a fair amount of younger children, but as I've gotten older, my recall base has gotten older, right? So I'm seeing more of those 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 year olds. And, you know, 18, 19, I try to start getting them over to the adult dentist. But I did not want to be the type of practice where I had this conversation with a hygienist, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago. And she said, my one rub with pediatric dental offices is I find that many times they hold on to patients too long, and they may transition to my office and to the general dentist, and they've got calculus and they've got perio issues. They've never had any probings. And I didn't want to be that guy, right? If I'm going to hold on to those patients, I need to treat them just like they would maybe in a general office. And that can be a struggle as our patients get older if we don't adapt and learn new things. And that's why I've been on this journey, even for younger kids or for teenagers. Number one, I just didn't want to do profies all day. I wanted to really expand my clinical skills and acumen. But you're 100% right. As I've gotten older, my patients have gotten older as well.
Mm-hmm. And going back to, because I forgot to follow up on this, but you know, your patient base there in California, are you in the area, like a community in California where you're more of like an urban, higher, you know, when I think of California, I think a lot of wealthy urban areas, high taxes, but high socioeconomic status, maybe parents that have more like higher aesthetic expectations, or are you kind of in more of like I don't want to say rural community in California. This just shows how naive I am with California, but walk me through a little bit more about your demographics of where you're practicing, just to give me some context there.
To give you context, I'm not in LA, but I'm not in Central California in the farms, right? So the city where I practice, I would say it's one of those communities where it's, you know, kind of upper middle to upper middle class. Parents typically have the income and the insurance to seek the best care for their patients, but I'm not having many parents come in and say, okay, I want you to bleach my four-year-old, right? I'm not in that type of community. So I'm really in I like the dynamic where I am, where I have parents that are able to do treatment. I would say my caries rate is not the same. I previously had taken over my father's second practice in a different community. It was only about a half an hour away. And that was a different story. Every child came in. It was a little bit more closer to Central California. And every child came in with huge wraparound caries on all their teeth. And I see some of that, but I like the community that I'm in. I find that parents are reasonable. You know, again, I'm not being asked to bleach four-year-olds, but I do have parents, teens and parents that are seeking out you know, to do some aesthetic dentistry. And I do enough of it to keep myself happy. And, but I'm not, you know, an aesthetic only based practice. I never want to be one of those, you know, I still like interventional pediatric dentistry. But I just wanted to expand my clinical skills as I was referring quite a few patients out as they got older, you know, 12, 13, if they had class two caries in every single tooth, I was referring those patients out. And, you know, unlike a rural practice, you know, maybe where you are, where you're the only pediatric dentist around for a while, I think it's way harder for guys like you because the buck stops with you, right? And so if you don't feel comfortable with certain procedures, you may just have to do them, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. Yeah. I took a mucoseal out this last week on Wednesday, and it was a Medicaid kiddo. And I'm just like, you know, you get those weird ones and you're like, well, I can send this out, but like, she's not going to follow up. They're not going to go to the oral surgeon 25 minutes away because they don't even accept insurance. So I wound up like, you know, I clamped it and cut it out and it went fine. The kid did well, but exactly to your point, sometimes the more rural you are, the more you have to be willing to accept. You're going to maybe have to do things on the edge of your comfort zone to help the kids out once in a while.
But I think that's a good place to force you to continue to educate yourself, right? And to be the best clinician you can and expand your knowledge base because you don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm. This reminds me of a conversation I had with Sean Whalen, who's a pediatric dentist in Denver. I had this podcast probably a year and a half ago, but he said something that piggybacks off this conversation that he realized that, you know, he wasn't very good at suturing. And so all these like Medicaid kids at the time he was seeing, he would extract every time he would do like a second molar extraction and that papilla is hanging there. He like, even though he didn't have to, he put a suture in every single one because he realized he was deficient in that area. And after a year, he was like, yeah, I was a whiz at suturing. And I always thought that was kind of like cool to, you know, because it gets very easy to just become like a one trick pony where you're a pediatric dentist and all you can do is like a seal and a stainless steel crown and a single composite or something. So it's nice to like keep that skill set kind of diverse and keep those skills sharp and everything.
Right. And I think the key is for our community as pediatric dentists to make sure that people are offering the type of education that we need to grow those practice skills. And that's really always been my driving factor as I became more of a dental educator. You know, I'm still in private practice 4 or 5 days a week, but dental education is a big part of what I do. It's what I'm passionate about. And my goal is to help those pediatric dentists, those ones that say, you know what, I want to do better work. But when you and I in residency, there's not a lot of time to learn everything, right? We're worried about seeing special needs patients. We're worried about the OR backlog that's 6 months out, right? We don't have the time to sit there and learn about how to put a rubber dam on an anterior tooth and make sure it's inverted and, you know, how to do that perfect class two composite. That's just not in our wheelhouse at that time. It just can't be.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe let's shift gears because I wanted to leave plenty of time to talk. The two additional things I wanted to chat about, one being some of the composite topics, and then maybe we can wrap, you know, the later part of the conversation, talk about the build out and your teaching facility you're doing because it looks like a cool build out. So, you know, you kind of gave me a good backstory of like how you got more into, you know, keeping your expanded skill set and everything. But my understanding, you do a lot with is BioClear, right? I think is the system that you use and that you kind of teach a lot. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. BioClear is both a matrix company as a whole, right? They sell these clear mylar matrices that are shaped like the tooth. And a big component of what I do is education as well, because it's one thing for someone to hand you a product versus someone to train you how to use that product.
Mm-hmm. And is BioClear, I've never personally used it. I think a previous office I was at had it. And to your point, I never was trained on it. So I always just reach for the old fashioned straight mylar strip and a little wedge and just kind of, you know, freehanded it of sorts. But do they do, besides class three, do you have like a class two system as well? Like do they make a class two system?
100%. And that's really how I came into teaching, was through class two composite. So during my residency, it was your choices in the posterior are stainless steel crown, class two amalgam, a sealant, maybe an occlusal composite, or you take out a tooth and you put a space maintainer, right? And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. That is classic pediatric dentistry. That's how we all initially should be taught. That's the base of a residency programs. But when I got out to private practice, I realized that mama doesn't necessarily want amalgams in the posterior, and she doesn't want a stainless steel crown. And again, there is nothing wrong with those restorations because they're still placed today and they hold up well, and especially a high caries rate child where they're not getting supervision and the diet is not ideal. There's still definitely a place for those restorations. But when I got out, I just felt like when I started doing class two composites, I was not happy with them. And I learned very shortly or very quickly that composite is not white amalgam. It is a very, very different material. And I wasn't happy with my contacts. It didn't look necessarily like a tooth for a class two. I was getting failures. I'd get sensitivity. And no one could give me a good answer. There wasn't one place where I could go to. So I started this long journey of going from company to company and reading articles and spending hours on YouTube to try to finally find a method to treat teeth so they actually look like teeth when they're done. And you, one of the big problems that we have as pediatric dentists is if we place a class two restoration on, let's say, that autistic 11-year-old that you're bringing to the OR, we don't have the opportunity to go back in if it fails in a year, right? We need to do definitive care. For our general dentist colleagues, they place a class two composite and it fails a couple years on Mrs. Smith. Sorry, Mrs. Smith, didn't work out. You know, let's just redo it. I won't charge you and let's get this thing done. You and I don't have that ability for a large percentage of our population.
Right. Mm-hmm. So maybe let me transition into, I'm not trying to like have you spill all of your wisdom because you teach and I want you to keep some of your cards close to your chest here, but like, could I maybe have you go through three or four or five, like either common mistakes or like pearls that you have found, to kind of improve, your composite success. So that could be like for primary class twos, it could be permanent, you know, composites. And it could be, you know, isolation techniques, material techniques, things you think people do well. Like just if you can try to maybe rattle off some common misconceptions or things you find that dentists in your courses are doing maybe not incorrectly, but like if they did something different, they would have better outcomes. What are some common things that you think would improve, you know, your average dentist listening to this?
That's great. And, you know, I never keep my cards to my chest. There's no like, you know, industry secrets here. My goal for any colleague that I help is I want them to do the best work possible. And I have no problem in sharing as much information. You know, like when we get done with this podcast, I'll give you my contact information. I have people call me all the time or email me or message me saying I'm having a problem with XYZ. Can you help me out? Fine. I'll stay on the phone with you. We'll, you know, sit under the microscope under Zoom. But that's really, I feel like I've been given such good training and I'm finally happy with my work to the point where I feel like I've got a good handle on things. And if I can share that with any of us, any of our pediatric dentist colleagues, I'm happy to. So I'm very thankful for the opportunity today. So let's go through those things. If I call it my brain download, right? If you were to call me and say, Josh, you know, I'm having problems. Someone just posted this on an IPEDO. Well, I'm having failures of my class two composites. What's going on, right? Mm-hmm. So number one by far is a failure to clean biofilm, plaque, Cheetos, gummy bears, all the things that we see every single day off the teeth. What I encourage everybody to do, first thing, and you can do this Monday, is if you have disclosing solution in your office, which most of us do, right? We use it for under hygiene appointments, you know, for patient education, is when you get ready to seal that tooth or place that occlusal composite or that anterior composite, do all the steps you would normally do, you know, your isolation, your preparation, all those things. Right before you take that etch and you put it on the tooth, put some disclosing solution on and rinse it off. And once you do that a few times, I promise you, you will use disclosing solution every single time. I call this my restorative existential crisis when I was taught that, right? Dr. Clark at BioClear in Tacoma, it was the first thing that when I trained and I started the avenue through the posterior. And when I saw how much stuff is left behind, I had this light bulb go off. That's why my sealants are failing. That's why I'm having composites that, you know, may ditch out. That's why my anterior is pickup staining. That's why maybe my class two is not lasting as long as I want it to. And it's a pretty simple concept. You know, you wouldn't paint that wall in your house without doing some preparation first. We have to have a clean surface. And I laugh sometimes when I see these advertisements of, you know, oh, try this restorative material. It's 0.2 megapascals, higher bond strength than the other. Yes, that may be true. But if we don't have a clean surface ahead of time, you might as well not do it. So first thing, Monday morning, you know, if you take your bristle brush or your toothbrush and you run it over the top of your occlusal surface to do those sealants on the sixes, stop, put disclosing solution on, and then I want you to tell me what you see left behind. And if your tooth is clean, great, more power to you. But I tell you, it is not for most of us. And I just have slide after slide showing just all the stuff we leave behind.
Okay. So question for that first one, let's say that I walk into the office and start doing that for either sealants or a big occlusal on a 14 or something. And I find that I'm still getting some stain and deep grooves. Do you have a preferred method or suggestion for getting that cleaner, you know, without being more aggressive with the burr and extending that prep? Are you an air abrasion guy? Do you like a bristle brush pumice? Do you like, are you a physiotomy guy? What's kind of your go-to for cleaning that plaque off?
So my go-to for everything is particle abrasion, whether that be BioClear, the company I teach with, makes a blaster, and it's basically a very simple unit that has aluminum trihydroxide. So aluminum trihydroxide is different than aluminum oxide that we use with standard air abrasion, right? So aluminum trihydroxide it's actually a food grade additive. It's safe. It's 40 times less hard than aluminum oxide. So you can take that powder, and it doesn't have to be through BioClear's blaster. Besides the BioClear's blaster, my favorite absolute, I could not practice without it. Velopex makes something called the AquaCare Twin, and it's basically an air abrasion unit, but it has a dial. So one dial, you can clean the teeth with aluminum trihydroxide or sodium bicarbonate or whatever particle you want to use. And then you turn it the other direction and it has aluminum oxide. And that is by far, it is a perfect harmony of cleaning that tooth, because I can clean off that surface, I can remove that biofilm, and then if I need to, I can turn it the other direction, and then I can cut tooth structure. Now, you know, that unit's a little pricey. It's about $3,500 or so dollars. BioClear's blaster is much, much less. It's, you know, probably a fourth of that. But it doesn't necessarily have to be BioClear's blaster, but any unit you can buy that's going to mix air and water with an abrasive powder to clean off the tooth. I implore people to use that. Now, that's for more surface cleaning, right? If you're going to clean out the grooves, and we know that in this world of heavy fluoride, we find these bombed out teeth all day that have these occult caries, right? Fishes are not just fishes. They tend to have dog legs. They tend to have these side canals where you can't see. So if there is stain, quote unquote, stain in the tooth, I like to open those teeth up first. So I will go ahead and I'll put on my disclosing solution first. If I'm worried that there's caries in that tooth, which I tell you far majority of the time there is, I'll either go in with air abrasion unit or I'll go in with a fissurotomy burr. I'll clean out those grooves and then I'll use something with aluminum trihydroxide, or if you don't have that, sodium bicarbonate, to just clean that surface. Once you do that a few times and you look just at that frosty enamel, you're going to be sold, because that's where the magic happens with your enamel bonding or your dentin bonding. You can have the best materials in the world, but if you're sitting in a pile of goo ahead of time, it's not going to do you any good.
Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't know if you were an air abrasion fan, and I didn't want to pry that out of you, but I was hoping you would say that, because I've the last maybe 1 or 2 years, I don't have a fancy unit. It's like a cheapo knockoff one. And mine doesn't even have water. It's just it's an air. And I use the aluminum oxide particle. You know, I do it on the back of the mirror and you know, it'll dull out the metal on the back of your mirror. But before any sealant now, I hit it, even if my assistants are helping me, but I grab that. I mean, it takes 2 seconds. It's all hooked up. Boom, boom, boom. But everything you just said, to your point, like, it's amazing how much frostier, and you don't get those like areas. Like, I think sometimes when you put etch over like the grooves. You know, a lot of times the etch is viscous enough where it doesn't always get way down into the far deep little cracks and crevices that like the air abrasion can get to. And so, you know, it might just be like my biasness, but I'm a big fan of the air abrasion is what I'm trying to say. So I'm glad you brought that up.
You just warmed my heart hearing that, because if there is one concept that I could teach fellow pediatric dentists, it's that. That's it. And I can sit here for 2 hours and talk to you about air abrasion and particle abrasion and all the different powder. I mean, we have 27 micron and 29 micron aluminum oxide. There's aluminum trihydroxide, but that's the number one thing by far. You need to have a clean surface.
So, okay. So knock that one out. Yeah. We could keep on chatting about that. Let's go. Right. Let's go to another key point of common mistakes.
Isolation. Right. Mm-hmm. So all of these materials are all moisture intolerant. Even if they say they have some, that they will allow some moisture, most of these materials are moisture intolerant, right? One of the reasons why people go to a GI is it's just a little easier because they can have a little bit of moisture in there. But one of the problems, and don't get me wrong, I use GI, I think it's great material, but if we're going to be using composite, whether that is sealant, whether that's an anterior composite, it's a bulk fill, doesn't matter. They are moisture intolerant. And I don't have to explain this too much to pediatric dentists, but if I'm teaching general dentists and prosthodontists, and I tell them there's this thing called a rubber dam and you put it on the teeth and it helps keep things dry, most of their eyes are just, you know, the size of saucers, because that's one of the first things they forget about when they get out of their dental schools or their post-grad training is the rubber dam. So, you know, whether that be rubber dam, if that's using, you know, an isolate, because we know some of our patients just won't tolerate it, but isolation. If you're doing large composites or you're doing, composites in the interior, just the breath alone, moisture from there is going to be causing a problem. So it's got to be isolation is number two.
Okay, so you're not anti-isolite. You keep that as part of your arsenal. If you rubber dam first, then if you can't get good isolation or the kid's struggling, you'll go to an isolite.
That's exactly it. Now, if I'm doing class twos in the posterior, if I'm doing a large buildup on a tooth instead of placing a stainless steel crown on a six or a seven, I'm using the rubber dam because I want to get that inverted. You know, the isolate's never going to give you the exact same amount of isolation. You're still going to get just from the breath. You're still going to have some, cavicular fluid alone just coming up. And some people struggle with rubber dam. And I think one of the problems is, and this is kind of a key point to some of us out there, is if you're using rubber dam clamps that are winged, sometimes that's an issue if you're doing a lot of class twos, because that terminal tooth, you may have a problem getting your ring down if you've got, wings on your rubber dam clamp. So that's, the courses I teach specifically to pediatric dentists, I spend a lot of time talking about rubber dam and rubber dam clamps. And if people have questions about, which rubber dam clamps or they're having issues with it, feel free to contact me. I'm happy to walk you through it.
Okay. What else? So I don't know if you can make this a point number three, but I wanted to make sure we spent time talking about like some material specifics, like what materials you like. You know, it sounds like you're not, you use glass ionomer as part of your arsenal, which is good. You know, if you've got a hypoplastic tooth or isolation's tough or maybe a special needs kiddo. What are some other, are there any materials maybe that you try to avoid? And then I can get into specifics of like the brands and things that you like using, but any materials that you've used in the past that you shy away from now or that you encourage people to be careful with, like since you've been doing this for a while?
I don't necessarily have ones to shy away with. I would say be careful with any material. Be careful about your curing and your curing times and making sure that your lights have been tested. There are so many offices that I've gone to or I've encouraged people to bring their lights into me. And I have a system called Checkup or Checkmark. If you work with 3M, if you have a local 3M rep, ask your 3M rep to come to your office to test your curing light. So it's one thing just to use a radiometer, maybe the radiometer that your light came with, but this system connects to the computer via Bluetooth and you test your lights and you can actually put in whichever composite that you use, whatever bonding agent you use, and it will tell you if you need to augment the depth or the time. And one of the problems with composite is we know that depending on what composite it is, there can be depth of cure issues. And that is a killer, right? I've gone in the posterior now to more of a bulk fill composite. Now, that doesn't mean you can put 8-9 millimeters of composite there, but in the posterior, I use 3M's bulk fill material, and that composite's got a 4 millimeter depth of cure from the occlusal. Now, if you're using a clear mylar like I am in the posterior, you can go up to 5 millimeters, right? But classic Filtek Supreme Ultra, the one in the blue compule, that's only two millimeters of depth of cure. And people push it. And when people push it and you don't get depth of cure, that's one of the other reasons that our composites are failing on us in the posterior. So I would say it's not material specific. It's making sure that you actually read the material. Somebody was by bonding agent and you don't read the instructions. Read the instructions, because there are very specific reasons why those chemists gave you those instructions. So I would say whatever material you're using, use it the right way. Have your lights tested. Have 3M come in. Or you can look up online the checkup system, and you can buy the little box, the radiometer, test all your lights. It comes with these labels, little barcodes you can put on your lights. I test my lights every 3 months, but it doesn't matter the manufacturer. I'll give you a case in point. We had one of our 3M Epilar lights, excellent light. Someone dropped it, and it light output looked like it was fine. And I put it on the radiometer, I put it on my checkup system, and there was almost no output coming from it. So that, I think, is more important than anything else in the actual materials that you're using.
Okay. Let's say somebody challenged you, they say, Josh, do I need to spend $1,800 on a Velo Grand? Are you really particular towards one type of curing light, or do you find that as long as it fits XYZ bill, it should be fine to use?
What I would say is stay away from the $20 Amazon lights, because it's not a matter, unless you really plan on checking the outputs of those lights often, that could be the issue. So all the top brands of lights, if you look at 3M lights, if you look at Velo lights, those lights are really well made, and they're made to use and abuse and use for a long time, right? But with any light, I'd say you've got to check the light, and you need to follow the manufacturer's recommendations as far as curing times and curing depths. So I think if you stick with any of the large manufacturers and you test your lights, you're going to be fine. But to me, I'm going to buy a decent light, because if you have a problem with their light, that may be hundreds or thousands of restorations that you place that you had improper curing depth or time. It's a big deal, especially in our patient population.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's, with the amount of people that do startups listening to this and being in those shoes recently, I know that's an area that I battled with a lot. When you first get going, you don't have any extra cash flow. Every dollar you got to count really tight. It's hard to swallow spending a lot of money on a curing light. So for the first couple years, I never got a $20 cheapo one, but gradually as I've been opening, getting busier, it seems like every year I upgrade and get nicer and nicer lights. And then I kind of graduate some of those older lights. So I've got, most of mine are $500 lights, but I'm about to the point I need to just invest and get some really high dollar ones for my heavy hitter workhorse ones. But, but that's good advice. I think for the guys that are doing, guys and gals doing startups and dollars are tight. There's places to pinch some pennies, and maybe you don't need the high end, but trying to get at least something of moderate quality, at least, a couple $100 is probably not a bad idea, and check it regularly. Maybe I would say
that is 100% what I would say. It's just check your lights, make sure, and check your lights with your own composite. And that's why I like that system, is you can select the composite on their app, and it will tell you if your light is getting proper depth of cure and strength, that the wavelength is appropriate for it.
Mm-hmm. It's cool too that you also said you like the Filtek, the one bulk is, I started playing with that too. And that's now my bulk system. Like if I've got a big occlusal on a posterior molar, I started going to the bulk, and it's almost cause I was selfish. Cause sometimes if I'm doing, if I was doing just the regular Filtek, or I use sometimes a TPH, Spectra, when you're doing those 2 millimeter increments, sometimes you take your x-rays and you can see the little, lines between where you put your increments, and it would always bother me. So I started using that Filtek bulk on those back molars, and I've had really nice results with it. So I'm glad to hear that that's a material you like as well, which is cool.
Yeah. And the big thing about 3M composite, and just for just to be clear, you know, I am a KOL for 3M, so I don't take any money from 3M, but I do product testing from them. All the composites in my office are 3M. So I think it's always important if anyone's talking about a product to you know, let that be known. But I, again, I don't take money from 3M and never have. The reason why that I use 3M composite is the technique that I use in the anterior or posterior is I'm using heated composite for everything, right? If someone would hand me just a room temperature composite right now, you know, let's say if I'm color matching and I've got to take that that gun and try to squish out the composite on the tooth, it just feels like rocks to me. So 3M right now, their Filtek, either the anterior or the posterior composite, Filtek 1 or the bulk fill, is the only composite that has FDA clearance to heat. So in every single one of my operatories, I have a composite warmer, and it warms that composite to, you know, about, you know, 150 or so degrees. And that allows that composite to really feel, it's much more creamy. It's easier to adapt. I don't incrementally place composite anymore whatsoever. Everything I'm doing is injection molding, either anterior or posterior.
Okay. So let's talk about this. And to make this a good transition, can I ask some power quick questions on materials, just like quick hitter questions?
Please.
Material questions. When you're doing sealants, you got your good isolation. And I know that you use a lot of 3M products. Do you use a classic sealant that's like a purely resin-based sealant, like an Ultra Seal, or do you like using more of like the, you know, there's a like a, an Embrace or like a Ultra Seal Hydro? You know, there's a lot of the new moisture tolerant resin sealants. Do you have any opinions on those?
I do. You know, my master's, my master's thesis was with Pitt & Fisher sealant. So it's something I love to talk about. So number one, with the sealant, like we discussed, you've got to clean off the tooth. Mm-hmm. Number two, if the tooth is not hypoplastic, if I'm not worried about caries in the grooves, if I hadn't had to take that air abrasion to it, then what I'm using is Pulp Dense Embrace. And I've been using that for quite a long time. You know, it has some moisture tolerance to it. It actually wants your tooth to be a little bit moist, but I've had really good success with that sealant over time. Now, when I teach sealants, one of the important concepts is sealant goes in the tooth and not on the tooth, right? The sealant is supposed to only be in the grooves. And I see so many sealants. One of the reasons why they fail is they pile 8 pounds of sealant on the tooth. But, you know, number one is once that tooth is clean, there's not caries. It's just your standard Pitt & Fisher sealant that I'm using, Pulp Dense product. I've been using that for as long as I remember, and I think it's absolutely perfect. Cool. Number two, if the tooth is hypoplastic, if there is more of a PRR, if there's some caries in the tooth, if I'm chasing something in there, what I'm going to use is, you know, once I clean off the tooth gets etched. And then we call this just one step. So I'm going to use 3M's, their bonding agent, and that gets applied into the tooth, and we don't cure it. So here's one clinical tip here is if you're just in the enamel alone, specifically with Scotchbond Universal Plus, they actually tell you if you're purely in enamel, don't cure it ahead of time. So you can go ahead and etch your tooth, 3M Scotchbond Plus. You don't need to worry about adhesive time or scrubbing it in if you're just an enamel. So it gets applied to the tooth with a brush, it gets air thin, and then I'll take the flowable, the Filtek 1, and I'll trace it into the grooves, then I'll cure it, right? And what I call an occlusal versus sealant is really based on if I'm, you know, removing caries or not. Sometimes my staff yells at me because they said, well, this really should be an occlusal versus sealant. I don't know if it's only taking me a very short amount of time. I'm not going to bill it out as an occlusal, but to me, that's kind of ideal because you're getting the best of both worlds. You're getting some adhesion there with that bonding agent, and then you're putting in a flowable composite versus a sealant. So it's one of those two things that I'm using for my sealant or, you know, very small fissurotomy kind of prep and sealant.
And Josh, I'm going to sleep well tonight because like I feel like you and I are very, very similar in the materials that we use, but like you've put a lot more homework and have a lot more years of follow-up. So it's making me feel good about, I'm like an Embrace fan and like I don't cure a lot, you know, I'll bond before sealing and I thin it, but I don't cure the, so we just like do a lot of things very similar and it's making me That's happy great. Here. That's why I'm smiling. I was going to ask, It sounds like you use Scotch Bond. Any bonding tips or suggestions? You know, are most of the new modern 7th+ generation bonds pretty solid choices? Are there any that you've not had good luck with, or any specific bond tips?
The key is following directions. So I'll tell you about Scotch Bond Universal Plus. I like Scotch Bond Universal Plus because when they reformulated, they increased the silane content. So it's a little bit more radio opaque. So even if, you know, there's times when you do that perfect class two and you know, you may see a little lucency right at your margin and think, no, I had this thing sealed, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just that bonding agent that's there that has a little bit of radiolucency to it. But the key with all these bonding agents, again, is follow the directions, right? Mm-hmm. So the number one, or one of the reasons why people get sensitivity in posterior composites if they're into the dentin, is they're not scrubbing that that bonding agent into the dentin for enough time. If you're just slapping on the dentin, it's not going to be enough time. For mm-hmm. 3M's bonding agent, specifically, you know, for Scotch Bond Universal Plus, it's 20 seconds. And 20 seconds really means 20 seconds, right? 10 seconds, excuse me, not 20. But you got to follow directions, right? If you don't follow directions, if someone calls me and says, hey, I'm having problems with XYZ, let's go back and tell me all the steps. If you didn't follow the directions, that's going to be a problem.
Okay. That's helpful. So, and one of my last power questions here was, you know, you touched on flowable and like a composite injection technique. And I wanted to kind of give you a thought and then just have you reflect on that. So, I have progressively, people that listen to the podcast know, for primary teeth, I like using a lot of flowables. And I do a lot of snowplow technique with permanent teeth, conceptually. And this is where I'm hoping you can give me some feedback, but I've always thought, like, if I'm like, historically we're trained to like put composite, which warm composite's great, put that in the box. And then you take a ball or a plunger and you start plunging it all away. I've always thought, like, with light and magnification, you're looking like, you sometimes when you're doing that, like, you'll just microscopically pull on that composite every time you go up and down. And like, I always feel like, am I causing a bunch of gaps on my, at my margin edge with that packable composite? So I've started using a lot more flowables which is kind of frowned upon because everybody's like, oh, you shouldn't use flowable on permanent teeth. But my thought is, like, a lot of these newer flowables are, I think the technology is a lot better, where I just, my margins always feel a little bit better. And I always maybe sleep a little bit better knowing that I had composite all the way up to the edge of my prep. There's no little gaps or voids. So I've been using a lot more flowables and like snowplow techniques and stuff, but I was just maybe going to have you educate me or just give me your thoughts on, like, do you like using flowables? Are you still nervous about using them? Do you have good success? Do you like to inject your composite in a way where you don't play with it a lot to avoid getting gaps? Like, give me some thoughts on that topic there.
Yet again, you warm my heart, because all the things that you just talked about are key concepts in when I'm teaching posterior composites. And I'm not just saying that to be nice. It really is true. Here's the thing. Number one, composite is not white amalgam. The word packable composite should be removed from our lexicon, because there's no such thing. Amalgam, you can condense. So I'll give you a little brief insight in how I place composites specifically in the posterior. So what I'm using is a clear matrix, right? I'm using a clear matrix, again, foam bioclear, and full disclosure, I am a full instructor at the Bioclear Institute. So, and I do teach these things, I have classes. But number one, I'm using a clear matrix. It never made sense to me. Why are we using a metal matrix for a light cured material? It makes absolutely no sense. When you take that metal matrix out, even if you think that you've cured all the way down in your box, you're not getting photons that far down. You're using a mirror that you are curing against, right? So all the matrices that I use, anterior, posterior, they're all clear mylar. They're shaped like the tooth, number one. Number two, the technique I'm using is injection molding. I do absolutely no conscious layering. I'm not putting in multiple layers of composite every two millimeters. So basically the steps for Clark class two, or the type of posterior composites I'm placing class twos, are the matrix goes in, I'm using a ring and then a wedge, all from BioClear. I etch for 20 seconds, then I'm gonna rinse that. Then I take the Scotch Bond Universal Plus, I'm just scrubbing into the dentin and the dentin only for 20 seconds, air thin, And then if it's deeper than a light cure, adhesive goes into the whole preparation, including the enamel. I'm going to air thin. Then I'm using flowable composite, and I'm actually filling most of that cavitation, most of that cavity with flowable composite first. But there's a caveat. So I'm using that flowable composite. I'm sweeping from buccal to lingual or lingual to buccal, and I'm getting that flowable in all the little nooks and crannies around the tooth. Then without curing, I'm grabbing my Filtek 1, my bulk fill, and I'm actually injection molding into that pool of flowable composite. I mean, 95-97% of that adhesive is coming up, that flowable is coming up, and what I'm really left with is what we call paste composite. So we don't have packable in my office. It's either room temperature or it's paste. It's coming out of the warmer. And when you inject that heated paste composite, basically what you're doing is you're filling all those little nooks and crannies into the tooth. And with a clear matrix, I'm actually circumferentially wrapping that tooth in composite. So my class twos are going to wrap somewhere from, you know, around the buccal line angle, around the lingual line angle, and I'm ensconcing almost a third of that tooth in composite. So I don't marginate composites anymore, but you can only do this with a clear matrix. You try to do this as metal, it's going to be a disaster because you're going to wind up getting flash. So everything I'm doing is injection molding. The only time I'm layering is if I have a depth of cure more than 5 millimeters, I'll put some flowable down first into the deeper portions. And then I do my normal injection molding technique on top of that.
Cool. Tell me with finishing, you know, because I'm going to have to check out, I like the theoretical concept of the clear matrix. You know, normally I take the sectional out. I use Garrison currently, but I'll take that out and then I try to cure buccal lingual. But I, to your point, like it's hard to get the light all the way down there. So if you are a dentist where maybe you're an associate in an office and the owner's not interested in switching to BioClear and you're stuck with what you've got, how can you finish, you know, if you do that injection molding step and you want to get like a really nice finished result, what does your finishing look like? Are you a diamond guy, a carbide guy? You know, how do you polish it? Do you try to polish and, you know, finish as little as possible to not mess with margin? Like, tell me about your finishing process.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, and Garrison makes good products. You know, I used Garrison for years. I've done podcasts like this or online courses for them years ago before I switched over to a clear matrix. And, you know, the key for me is specifically, I'll talk about, you know, Mylar. There's nothing as shiny or as perfect as a Mylar to composite matrix, right? So I try to not manipulate cured material as much as I can. So I use a lot of discs. Mm-hmm. Around line angles, I may take a disc and just sweep up, you know, from the base of the rubber dam or from the gingival margin up. And then I'm using carbides. You know, I use a lot of diamonds for preparing teeth, but I'm using carbides or the disc. And then BioClear, I use their system. So it's a matter of using a magic mix, which is a kind of a clear polish or a pre-mix. And then I'm using a rubber cup wheel on a slow speed. I'm a big fan of electrics. I mostly use electrics in my office because, you know, they spin concentrically. And let's say if I'm using a brownie, I can dial that brownie down to 13,000 RPM and give it some pressure and use that to polish. Now, if you do that with an air-driven handpiece and you give it a little too much go, you know, it's going to explode on you, right? So I've used electrics for, you know, quite a long time. But I think whatever polishing system you use, what's more important to me is checking the occlusion afterwards. And if there's one little tidbit, I'll give everybody one little tip is go back to your anatomy textbooks. I'm talking permanent teeth here and look at marginal ridges. Okay. So many of us, especially with a metal matrix, when we adjust our occlusion, our marginal ridge is going to be flat across. And then we have the patient bite and it's high. What we forget about, and if you look at, you know, the mesial or distal surface of a premolar or molar, it's actually V'd a little bit, right? It doesn't go straight across. So many times what I see people do, instead of just giving themselves a little bit of a V on their marginal ridge, they take the whole marginal ridge down. The problem is then you're making a ramp. So every time that patient eats, you take that marginal ridge down. Now you've created almost a guide plane like we learned with partial dentures, and they are packing food there every single time. So when you check your occlusion, take it down a little bit, you know, try to match your marginal ridges and then give yourself a little V. Cause if you check your occlusion, you'll notice a lot of times you're hitting right in the middle of that marginal ridge, right centrally. And so don't take the whole thing down, give yourself a little V and then take the composite down. Even before then, and this is one tip someone could use on Monday, especially if you're treating multiple posterior teeth, check their occlusion ahead of time before the rubber dam goes on, before the isolate goes in. So if I'm treating more than one posterior tooth for a class two, even for occlusals, I will check their bite. I'll grab my intraoral camera and I'll take a photo. Then I know where their natural contact points are. And that way, when I'm finishing my composite, I already know where those high spots usually are probably going to be. And I can then do my, you know, my finishing and polishing based on that photo that I have up on screen. And I know where their natural contacts are. And I found that someone taught me that years ago. And I do that every single time now. And it really has helped me dial in my speed and my occlusion afterwards. Because if not, we're guessing, right? You don't remember where their contact points are. If you take a photo before you start, you sure will.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny, all these, I love the thought and the depth that you've put into something as simple as like the anatomy of the tooth, which is easy to forget. But, you know, when you're in the trenches and you're doing a ton of these at scale and volume, you know, it gets easy to skip steps. And I've tried to be good about that, but I know my staff always rolls their eyes when it's like a GA day and I'm doing like, you know, 3, 14, 19, and 30, I'm doing big occlusals because they always take me so much longer. And, you know, I tell them, I'm like, man, to do these right, like you can't skip steps. It takes time. So it's just cool to like hear somebody like yourself who has a lot of success, like, you know, just spending a lot of time thinking about like the very little minutia of placing composites. Cause yeah, it gets easy on a day to day to try to start shortcutting things for the sake of time. But it's nice to know that there's still people like yourself who like really put a lot of time and thought into placing these so that they last and hold up for years and years and years to come. So it's very cool.
Thank you. And, you know, we have to. Our general dentist colleague may be treating just that operative patient and have one check, right? But as pediatric dentists, you may have that operative patient in the chair and the time's running for GA, or you've got five recalls booked against it and you don't want to rush your restorative. You want to do it right. So I think having these, you know, it really comes down to training and trying not to figure all this stuff out. And what I've tried to do in the last 20 years is all these courses that I've taken, all these mentors that I've had, they've all been general dentists or prosthodontists. So what I've tried to do is boil that information down. And that's why I, you know, developed this pediatric restorative course with BioClear specifically for our specialty, because there's really no one that I know that that's offering that level of education specifically for our specialty, right? We're not going to necessarily do, you know, the whole anterior composite veneers, right? That's more of a general dentist thing, but we're going to do single teeth. We're going to do maybe two teeth. We're going to close a black triangle. We're going to do a quadrant of posteriors. And my goal always is to make sure people are efficient. They do it quickly and they do a good job and they're happy with their results. I want to see those radiographs afterwards and see that contact right at the junction of the occlusal middle third and actually have it look like a tooth and have a marginal ridge roll and not these two blocky composites, right? Or have my composites, the anterior, actually look like teeth or have a fracture that, you know, doesn't come off it in a year. And if I can teach other pediatric dentists to do that, then I'm happy. Then my job is done.
That's very cool. You know, as we start kind of winding down on time, I wanted to just, as we finish out, talk about your new office build and the room or the education center you're putting in there. Is there anything, as we kind of tie up the conversation on the composite and bonding and material side of things, anything that you wanted to add? Any, you know, I started counting off like tips and pearls. We got to like number two and then we made number two, like a half hour conversation.
Right. Sorry about that.
But no, that's all good. Anything we missed, or any closing thoughts on like getting good composite outcomes, prior to us kind of finishing up here?
You know, I just want to plug using disclosing solution again and really making sure you cannot see biofilm with the naked eye. And so, you know, I would say that's number one. Number two, make sure that, your staff understands all the steps. One of the things that I do with any new team member is we'll take out a Tympanon, I'll prep a tooth and actually have them restore because I want them to learn all those steps, right? If I have somebody new, it's one thing for that person to watch me, but if they do the things themselves, you can buy an inexpensive Tympanon on, you know, eBay, have them restore a class two. I find they're more excited about it and then they remember the steps more because they've done those themselves.
Really good idea. Yeah. I'm going to write that down. Man, what a good idea. Yeah. Okay. So, we reviewed some composites. We had chatted briefly before the podcast that I know you are in the midst of doing this big build out, your floor plant, like you're building this super kick-ass looking office and you've got like a big, but tell me about like this project you got going on with building this new office and then how you're integrating, you know, you've got like a big teaching center kind of, or like a big room for lecturing inside of it. Like what are the updates on that project?
Yeah, thank you. So I'm really blessed to be able to be starting to wrap up, you know, the office of my dreams. Right now I'm in 8 chairs at about 2,600 square feet. And I have a staff of, I don't know, 14 of us are all sharing, you know, a restroom and a kitchen. I've got staff members, you know, that are, you know, sitting on the counter trying to eat lunch because they're all packed in together. So I had the opportunity. I finally said, you know what, it's time. I need a bigger facility. So I was able to, you know, purchase a building for the first time. I've always been leasing, but I was able to purchase a building. And so the office I'm building now, I'm going to about 5,800 square feet. So 12 ops and then a full consult area. And one of the things that I'm able to do there is, you know, I teach a lot of courses, and I was teaching most of my courses on Zoom, or I was flying out all over the place, which, you know, gets to be tough, especially, you know, in pedo, when we have such a need for our patients to be seen. And, you know, I have, you know, part-time associate, but I really wanted to do everything in my office, because then I've got control over people flying in, and I know I've got the education setting completely set up. So part of my build out is a teaching center. So I have a conference room that seats about 18, and we have the ability, two of my main ops also in the office. I use surgical microscopes quite a bit. I'm a big fan of magnification. So I either use 6x or 8x loops when I'm doing just regular restorative dentistry. And then I have 2 Zeiss microscopes that I use as well. So in the teaching center, we have it set up where it's connected to my office, and I can seat about 18 people. And so we have the ability to do some of the classroom, or do all the classroom work there. And there's 2 large screens where, you know, we can lecture. There's a podium set up so we can get all of that out of the way. But really the key is getting into the clinic. So in all the chairs, I have everything set up now where there's 2 screens per operatory. One is going to be live video feed and one is the PowerPoint. And all of those stations will be set up with type-outs, all the materials, just like the courses I teach now, either in Tacoma or online with BioClear. But I'll have the ability to have, you know, 13 docs at a time come in and hands-on train. And that's where the magic happens, right? I like Zoom, and I've, because of COVID, most of my courses I've done over Zoom over the last couple of years, just because it's been harder for people to fly. But really where I'm transitioning now for my BioClear for the pediatric dentist is a 2-day course, anterior and posterior, but it's going to be all hands-on. So that classroom really is set up where, you know, I can stream either from a doc camera in the classroom or one of my surgical microscopes, and it's as hands-on and live stream it as possible. So I'm excited. We just had cabinets started yesterday. They started putting them in. So I should be wrapped up by the end of next month. And then September is our go live for patients. And then I'm still working with BioClear and getting dates. I've had so many people message me, you know, asking when the next course is. And the caveat's just been, I didn't want to book a course until the construction's done, because we know sometimes that can take a little bit longer. But on iPedo, I typically as well, you know, if you search in my name or BioClear and iPedo, you're going to see all the courses I taught in the past. And we're going to be transitioning mostly all of those courses. I may do an online once in a while, but we're going to transition those courses to hands-on in office. So I'm really, you know, what I'm trying to establish is I think the only training center for our specialty for pediatric dentists in the country, and really make it worthwhile for someone to fly out and learn a lot in 2 days.
Yeah. If somebody wants to follow that or has questions, because it sounds like this is kind of a work in progress, people are going to want to stay tuned to it. I know you're on Facebook and iPedo and social media quite a bit, but is that a good place to get in touch with you? What's some good contact info if people want to, like, are interested in taking this course and want to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So I will always announce the courses on iPedo, and I know it's been tough for people because I normally only gave them once a year, and now I'm giving them more and more. Once I set that schedule, and it's going to be a year out, so there'll be dates so people can, you know, they don't have to do this last minute, but iPedo is going to be probably the best way for BioClear for them to find courses. You can message me, just look up my name on, you know, on Facebook quite a bit. I'll give you my email address. I'll give you my personal one through the office. So that's joshua@pediatricdds.com. So pediatricdds.com. So feel free. You can, you know, get a hold of me on Messenger and Facebook, or you can email me personally if anyone has any questions. And I'm available. If people have, you know, if they're listening to this podcast and they've been struggling with composites and they just want some advice, email me. I'm happy to help you.
Very cool. Well, Josh, I'm going to put this course on my list. Going back to what we talked about, I think it's a sign of a good pediatric dentist to always be like hyper-analyzing and looking at your work and how's it holding up and is there a way to do dentistry better and more efficiently. And you've kind of piqued my interest, especially like my class threes could use some work. So I'm going to put this on my tentative to-do list when life is a little slower with this baby situation. I'm going to fly out to California and we're going to do this live in person. We'll do a live podcast when I'm out there and I'll do the CE course. We'll knock out a couple birds with one stone.
That would be absolutely phenomenal. I'm really looking forward to that. Congratulations on the birth of your baby.
Hey, thank you, Josh. I appreciate it. Well, thanks for carving out some time on a Sunday. I enjoyed this episode and I feel like it was a good refresher on some, restorative techniques. So thank you for your time. And I'm hoping we can meet up in person out in California sometime. I look forward to it.
We definitely will. Thank you. I appreciate it, everyone.
All right, Josh. Have a good weekend. See ya.
Take care.
Yep.
Thanks for listening to the Brews and Tiny Teeth podcast. Be sure to DM our host, Casey Getz, on social media with any listener questions, comments, or tough clinical situations. We'll see you next week for another unfiltered episode.